Linda, is it your first time with us? You're muted.
Yes, my first time.
Well, welcome. Where are you zooming in from?
Portland, Oregon.
Oh, wow. Not far away. We have people from all over the country, so or outside the country, as in some cases. So, yeah. Well, so hello to you.
Hi, hello.
And I'll go around and greet everyone else as well, starting with Katie and Paul, Peter, and Tyler, Sam, Jim, Drew, Susan, John, Karen, Shane, Marv, Franklin, Shoketsu, Joan, Gathel, Bob, and Coral and Carson. All right. Oh, let's see. In terms of announcements, next week is our Rohatsu retreat starting on Monday evening. And the schedule, it's all via Zoom, and the schedule is on the website. You're welcome to join us for any part of it. If you want to, you know, kind of commit to any of it, whether it's part-time or full-time, I invite you to register. And I don't have to cook for you or come up with work assignments for you or anything. So, you know, you don't, not a big deal to register, but it's kind of nice to know, all right, you know, each day there's going to be a core group of maybe 5 to 8 people with other part-timers dropping in and out. So, yeah, so you, when you register, you can indicate what parts of the retreat you might be there for. But I'll, like I said, please feel free to drop in. And so next Tuesday, if you log in, you'll just be joining us for Zazen. There won't be a class. But the Sunday, the 13th, December 13th, will be a normal Sunday. So the retreat will actually wrap up before our ordinary Sunday program. All right. And then we will go on a holiday break between basically Christmas Eve and New Year's. So look at our online schedule to find out when that is. And also, I don't know if you've been noticing in our newsletter, we have been featuring pictures of people's home altars. So I invite you to check out the newsletter, and there's a link beneath whatever altar is featured to a form that Lisa, who puts together our newsletter, put together. And you can also say a few words about your altar and what's on it and why, and et cetera. I think that's it. Anything anybody else can think of that I should mention?
Do we have Dharma tea on Saturday, or is that kind of or merged?
Let's see. So this Saturday we will have normal Dharma tea as usual, but the Saturday that's during Rohatsu will just be sitting.
Okay.
Thank you for reminding me of that. So it's the Tuesday and the Saturday that are kind of co-opted by the retreat schedule. Peter?
I am 4 years into my Buddhist study, and I use the term study very lightly because I don't like to read all that much, having been, you know, a professional in my first career. My question is, where might we go to get some coaching as to start an altar, as I don't have any altar whatsoever? And so I'm interested in, you know, picking the low-hanging fruit of starting your own altar.
Oh, that is a very good question. I believe there is something, if I recall. I believe there's something on the Dharma Rain website about it, but maybe do you get our newsletter, Peter?
I get emails. I don't know if that is the newsletter or not.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Our e-newsletter. I will find a reference. So then under the altar feature, then I'll put a like, and do you want to know how to make an altar? Ding. But it's very simple. It's basically, you know, some kind of central statue or image with a candle to the right if you're facing the image, a candle to the right and or a light, and then the flowers go to the left. And I have fake flowers because I just can't keep up with live flowers. It's kind of cheating, but the Japanese do it too. They use like fancy metal flowers and stuff like that. So that's the basic core. And then there's various other things that you can do, but it's a little formula that just is very recognizable. You know, you recognize, oh, that's an altar. But then, you know, sometimes I think about it and I would guess that even if somebody's not a Buddhist, or I mean, there are certain sects of Christianity that have altars and stuff too. But even if you don't consciously have an altar, I would guess that most people probably do in a way in their house. Somewhere there's an elevated place to keep kind of clear of clutter, and there's important things there. You know,
I have a piano. I mean, to me, that's my current altar.
That's where pictures of important people in your life go, or little symbols of important things to you, or whatever. So, yeah, good question. All right. So tonight we are continuing with our discussion of The World Could Be Otherwise by Norman Fisher. And we're doing the second half of the chapter on Kshanti, or the perfection of patience. So just to review a little bit, Kshanti can be translated a bunch of different ways. Patience, tolerance, forbearance, endurance. It's the virtue that we practice when we are facing some kind of difficulty or challenge, large or small, pain or discomfort, internal or external. And Fisher pointed out there's three classical categories of challenges that we face. So there's personal hardship, there's issues in our relationships with other people, and then there's facing the truths of our human life, the difficulties of just existence in general, just old age, disease, death, loss, just the things that we end up having to face just because we're human beings. And our natural and habitual responses to these things are, you know, we don't like them. It's natural that we don't like them. They're painful or difficult or challenging. And so our natural or habitual responses are our aversion or fear or anger. And we may act these things out by avoidance, seeking distraction, unleashing our anger, nurturing resentment, seeking to place blame. So I, as I said last week, and Norman Fisher agrees, I like the definition of Kshanti that I've come up with: not being stopped or thrown off course when in pursuit of our goals and aspirations, whether by circumstances, other people, or by ourselves. So I kind of like that focus on, this isn't just about putting up with shit in order to put up with shit. It's in order that we can stay, you know, true to ourselves and on course in our aspirations. So Fisher puts it like this: page 106. He said, basically, all I have said about the practice of patience amounts to something quite simple. Just keep going. Don't let anything that happens, including setbacks of any sort, deter you. In fact, there will always be setbacks. Setbacks are a necessary part of the process. So whatever is going on, whatever disadvantageous or even catastrophic thing occurs, just remember, be of benefit to others. Be a blessing for others. Just try to help, even if it looks like there's nothing you can do. In fact, you can always do something. Say a prayer, have a kind thought, offer a kind word. It will help. Frustrated by bad traffic or a very long checkout line? Be of benefit to others. Financial setback? Be of benefit to others. Job loss, divorce, illness, aches, pains, fear of old age? Be of benefit to others. The full perfection of the practice of patience can be effected with just this one practice. Be of benefit to others. So, anger and conflict is what most of the chapter was, the part of the chapter that we were focusing on today, focused on. And anger and conflict can certainly be intoxicating at times, but generally speaking, they're painful and stressful and troubling. When our anger is unleashed, we usually regret the results to at least some extent. So it's natural for us to judge our anger, to want to end it, to want to get rid of it. But anger and conflict, as Fisher speaks to so beautifully, is just, it's part of our human life. It's part of who we are as human beings. We're going to have these feelings arise, and conflicts are absolutely inevitable. So he points out how oftentimes if we have a conflict, it feels like a failing of some kind. Perhaps a failing of someone else, but a failure of relationship, a failure of our ability to get along with people or communicate or whatever. And yet it's just inevitable that we have. It's just part of life, right? And I always get struck by how I can sometimes, not always, but sometimes I'm coasting along in my practice, right? And I think, I'm doing pretty well. And then I'll just encounter a person who just has a problem with me. Or you know, there's some kind of disagreement that I can't navigate harmoniously, and it's just like it's so incredibly humbling, right? It's just like, wow, there it is, there's the limitations right there. So they're inevitable, and we're gonna face them. So Fisher says this about anger in particular, page 94. Anger surely has, okay, first of all, he agrees that, you know, I mean, there's reasons why we try not to let anger be in charge, right? It isn't rational or calming, associated with a sense of fear and threat. But he also says anger isn't intentional. You don't decide to be angry. It's just something that arises. And then anger surely has its legitimate place. Anger arises for a reason. Since every moment arises from the totality of past conditions, a moment of my anger is produced by everything that has ever happened to me, though it bursts forth now triggered by an event in the present. So this moment of anger must be here. There's no use regretting it or trying to avoid it. Here it is. This is what it feels like. I don't have to believe all of my thoughts about it, or act on them. Certainly I would be better off if I don't. But if I can be with the precious and inevitable moment of anger that has arisen, face and understand it, I will benefit. Possibly I will learn something valuable about myself and about being human. Possibly I will extend my capacity to understand and love others who also have in them the conditions for anger. Intimately being with anger when we are angry is the practice of patience. So I think for myself, sometimes when I think about practicing patience, I think I'm angry, so therefore I'm not practicing patience, right? I'm not patient yet because I'm still feeling upset. But, you know, essentially he's saying then our job at that moment is to simply be patient and present with our experience of anger. So he talks about being, you know, that mindfulness of anger, that ability to just notice anger as anger, to be able to embrace it gently and courageously rather than getting scared by it or to grab hold of it and wave it around. Relating to anger is a subtle matter you can't learn from a book. There is no other way but to see it in action for yourself in the unique patterns of your own body and mind. So I wanted to do a brief breakout with the following question. What are some ways anger and conflict are good or can be put to good use in our practice? So I will broadcast the question once people are in breakout rooms so that you can see it. And I want us to report back because I'd like to hear what people come up with. So please designate a secretary to jot down some of the things that are said. So what are some ways anger and conflict are good or can be put to good use in our practice? So any questions about that question?
Yeah, is it mostly about your practice or is it in life in general?
I think it covers both, because you know the first part is like what in some ways are they good, and then but then also you know so I guess it's kind of like two questions, and how can they be put to good use in our practice? So good.
Yeah, I dare ask the question: is there a difference between your practice and your life?
Well, I could see you wanting to see perhaps answering the question in terms of like more in the world, kind of in general, what role might anger and conflict play in human relations and
whatever. So I guess whether or not it's a personal or the greater world.
Yeah. All right. Give it about 10 minutes. All right. All right. I pushed another button and it extended the time the breakout rooms had, so I don't know what I did. All right. I would love to hear from the secretaries of the different rooms about some of the interesting things that were said about what are some ways anger and conflict are good and or, you know, how can we put them to good use in our practice?
I can start for our group. So one of the things that came up was that anger can create an energy for change. Someone mentioned that it can be morally informative, which is a phrase we all agreed we liked, and can propel us towards dealing with injustice. We also talked about conflict as being an opportunity to explore. Generally, we tend to think of conflict as being kind of an external event, but it's an opportunity to kind of explore our own internal rigidity. We said that conflict is an opportunity to create greater communication, and sometimes, if we're lucky, that communication, if it's kind of a mutually beneficial, can create greater intimacy. And then we talked a little bit about how, you know, one of the challenges in practice is that when we are, you know, when we have conflict that isn't so easy to resolve, or some people are just not receptive to, you know, changing their position or their way of being, and that's an opportunity for us to, as bodhisattvas, to continue to be loving regardless of their inability to move in any direction. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the main gist of what we talked about.
Thank you.
I was secretary for our group, so I can speak whenever. So I guess I'll go ahead and start. It's mentioned that anger can be a reminder that we've slipped into an uninformed life, that we're no longer practicing perhaps as we should be. Anger can surface underlying issues, allows you to look deeper into yourself and grow. Anger has a place for correcting injustice. I was reminded of a quote. I originally thought it was Buddha, but it turns out to be Dalai Lama. And it goes, to be angry toward the people in power does not create change. It creates more anger, more resentment, more fighting. To be angry on behalf of those who are treated unjustly means that we have compassionate anger. This type of anger leads to right action and leads to social change. Mm.
That's a wonderful quote. Thank you.
Yeah, I like that one too.
I was the recorder for room two, and so I think we started out by talking about how it was like a signal, that it was information. And I think it was Peter who said it was like, it reminded him of pain in the way that it was like a signal. It kind of, maybe kind of an imperfect signal, because it, like pain, doesn't always tell you what you need, but it at least gets you going on healing. And then there was more about some of the stuff other people already have covered, but yeah, we were talking about how when you are in the middle of a conflict with people, how being able to look at the anger can help you move on to, you know, to a better place in terms of your relationship sometimes. And then we talked about being conflict avoidant, and how sometimes if you don't do anything, if you never engage in anger, you'll never get past a certain point. And then, let's see, first in here. And then also that there's different flavors of anger, and some of the low-level angers might be a habit. And so those ones, perhaps by examining them more often, you can overcome that. So if anybody want to add anything from group two?
Okay. I think that was good.
Thank you.
Do we have one more group or two more groups?
Well, I'll do group three.
Okay.
Echo everything that's been said already. No need to plow that again. One one quote that came up out of the book was, conflict is betrayal of love, and love is at the bottom. And I discussed that a little bit, and still not sure that I understand that. I'll have to think about that some more myself. But then we came down to how to put it to use. And you have to start communications if there's anger or conflict in a relationship. You have to start talking about it, otherwise it won't get resolved. It clarifies our level or our beliefs and our values if you examine the conflict. It acts as a motivator or a motivation to action. And the last one is, it shows gaps in our practice. Why am I angry is a good question. And that's a practice kind of question. Did I miss anything, guys, in my room three? Okay, thank you.
All right, I think there were only four rooms, right, everybody? All right, yeah. I would make the case that we always have something to learn from the conflicts in our lives. The way that I'm going to talk about conflict, it does not mean that we don't take action. It doesn't mean that we don't have those conversations. So this is kind of this is our practice, our personal, our internal use of conflict. So there was a saying that we had at Dharmarine, where I practiced, grew up dharmically, which is, do your own practice. So there was very little, perhaps too little, discussion within our Zen community about why I don't like your behavior and your behavior needs to change because it's annoying me or bothering me in some way. There was very, very little of that. Sometimes perhaps there should have been some of that. But our first job was always to do our own practice and examine what was going on for us. So if we, whenever we feel negative emotions, aversion or anxiety or shame or resistance, judgment, it's just pointing out something that we can learn, some place we can grow, some point of limitation that we have. And I think it's really essential to recognize that there really should be no shame or guilt in Buddhism. That there's only shame or guilt or that kind of sense of self-judgment when we assume we have an independent, enduring, inherent self-nature. There's a me. There's a me who's good, or there's a me who's bad, or there's a me who's flawed, or there's a me who's inadequate, or there's me who's saintly and I don't get angry, or whatever it is. When that is really, this is a flow. Like Fisher was talking about, anger has arisen. You know, there's just this chain of events. It's my genetics, it's my history, some of it has been my habits. Here it is. It's anger arising right now. And like, in a way, it's just assigning blame, feeling bad about it, anything like that is just, there's just no point whatsoever. this is our precept, right? Do not dwell on past mistakes, create wisdom from ignorance. So the only thing we care about is taking responsibility right now, and what are we going to do next? So hopefully, you know, none of this is like saying that, you know, whenever we have a conflict or whenever we feel anger, we have something we can learn it sounds like it could be a little bit shaming, you know, a little bit like, well, you know, what's your issue that you should go examine? Nobody can make you angry. It's your own problem. So let's set that aside. So in this process of first being mindful, like he said, of what's going on, and in our group we talked about that how valuable the practice of kshanti or patience or endurance is, just in getting us to just be present with the feelings of anger or upset or whatever, to just be with them instead of having to, you know, fix them or avoid them or something, to just temporarily be with them. And then we're trying to get some kind of spaciousness around them, around the feelings, setting aside blame, setting aside problem solving, just looking as objectively as possible. You know, what are the thoughts going through my head? What are the sensations in my body? What am I experiencing here? And temporarily letting go of some of the explanations that we are coming up with. So when, you know, I'm rarely ever suffer from insomnia yet in my life, right? I'm very grateful for that. Except on rare occasions, and I'll notice that those occasions are when I'm having some kind of conflict with someone. And it'll just be I'll be laying there rehearsing my arguments with the person and why you don't understand and you're wrong. And I'm, you know, so I'm arguing my case in my sleep. And so kind of, you know, setting aside that whole narrative that we're creating about something and then just going, all right. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with nonviolent communication, but in a way it's like, okay, they said this and then I felt this, you know, it's like, all right, let's stop catastrophizing about the whole deal. And I'm a weak person and that they're a manipulative person, whatever. Just like, okay, they said this and then I felt like this. So trying to get some spaciousness around there. And then what I've found is very helpful to say, what can I let go of here? What is something, some piece of this puzzle that I can, that is optional, that I can let go of? I can't just through sheer force of will suddenly, you know, make this person understand me or not be upset about this thing. But is there any piece of this, any dukkha that I'm adding, any extra expectation or assumptions or whatever that I can go, like an example was, you know, and I think folks might relate to this. It was a conflict within a working group that I was part of, and just, you know, somebody took just offense at what I had done. I did something that they felt was very insensitive and you know, violated their trust and whatever. And I didn't mean anything by it, you know, but then maybe I was kind of oblivious. I don't know. So I just, you know, had that kind of internal argument going on. And I noticed that there was just this, I was very attached to just, I am a considerate and fair person, and I want other people to think I am a considerate and fair person. I need other people to think I'm considerate and fair. And when I just like, oh, that's interesting. And I thought, what if this one person didn't think I was considerate and fair? What about that? And I just recognize that in a way, like, is that the end of the world? Is that, do I have to have this person in particular believe I am considerate and fair? And so I just found this one little piece that I could release when I recognized it. And it helped ease some of that tension. So in that process, not just did some tension get eased, but also I learned a little something, you know, I learned a little something about where my concerns are and where my attachments are. So it doesn't make the conflict, the negative feelings magically disappear, but the dukkha can be decreased a little bit. But on the other hand, sometimes, and I think, you know, it's certainly not only in situations where anger and conflict arise, but they're pretty classic. Sometimes what's called for, so this is another practice saying that perhaps will stick with you. Often, what's really called for in our practice, if we feel up to it, is the hardest thing to do. So sometimes you might ask yourself, in this situation, what would be, for me, the hardest thing to do? So sometimes that might be shutting up and letting go, right? Sometimes that might be speaking up or fighting for something. Sometimes, I mean, and you don't always have to do the hardest thing. Sometimes I don't feel up to doing the hardest thing, but it's interesting sometimes to ask yourself that question. Like, the hardest thing to do here, would it, that be to, you know, express a little bit of anger in order to, you know, stand up for myself or someone else? Or would the hardest thing to do be to show some vulnerability that actually this situation is making me feel kind of unsafe or something like that? So the our practice, unfortunately, never lays out absolutes for us, right? It says you should never do this, you should never do that, you should always do this, you should always do that. It's like, it's always up to us every moment. So questions or comments about that?
Well, I was intrigued by that idea of doing the hardest thing, and I think it sometimes isn't necessarily even the hardest thing. It's just kind of like the non-habitual thing, mm-hmm. You know, the thing that you always do, and try and think of just another way. Yeah. And sometimes it's, that can be pretty neat. And if you're not, well, I mean, it just seems like we really get into habits of the way we respond to things. So that's really struck me.
I was really struck by how Norman Fisher gives you like the permission to have so much space. I mean, because he talked about this one student that he answered this question from the student who I think it was about someone that was, he was having trouble at work and claiming all of this person's ideas for their own. And, you know, he just really, he said, well, is it okay for you to let that person claim all of the your ideas or not, you know? And if it's not okay with you, then speak up for yourself. I mean, so it's whatever you have to examine and whatever you need to do, you know, because he says, when you're a Buddha, you can give the victory to others all the time, but you're not. So you can't do that yet. he was just so giving and so, I don't know, generous about everything. I just love this chapter.
Other thoughts, questions? When you were speaking, Joan, it made me think about, I guess part of the, it seems like part of what we're trying to do in Zen, or maybe the entire thing, what we're trying to do is to really become ourselves wholeheartedly. And so, there's a kind of a will, it needs to be a willingness to make mistakes also, which is really scary. Like, And if you're going to do something, I guess what occurs to me is like, if you're going to do something, don't feel guilty about it. Like, either do it or don't do it, but don't like, they shouldn't, like, which is, it's tough. I mean, that's a tough call, right? But I think that's part of the Bodhisattva aspiration, you know? Even if you're, if you need to face this person at work and you're quaking in your boots, but you've decided that this is what you're going to do and you know you're probably going to partly make a mess of it, but there it is. And like, it's all going to be part of the practice. And then we'll learn something, right? So I had more stuff to talk about and cover. In particular, I guess when we are practicing Kshanti, so you know, you've had some anger, some conflict arise. You know, in particular, you know, you've done through those steps, like I said, of kind of mindfulness and whatever. When we're able to practice some of the Kshanti, some of the patience, some of the endurance, does it change how we feel about or perceive or experience the subject of our anger? So does, you know, when you are able to practice some of that patience, is there a shift in your how you feel about or perceive or relate to what has been making you angry or been a source of conflict?
Please ask that again.
So you're able in a moment to practice some patience, practice some Kshanti, some endurance, some forbearance. You're able to be with the reality of your anger and your feelings of conflict. And how does that change your perception of your feelings about the subject of your anger?
I think just sitting with the sensation of anger, so being patient in the sense that you just stay with it and sit with it and see how it unfolds over time. Sometimes you see the other emotions that are mixed in with it. For example, like longing for a previous state of this relationship that was more harmonious, for example. So it can tell you something about the nature of the conflict and the nature of your relationship with that specific person, if you sort of stay with it and let it tell you what else it is, I guess, I would say.
I've found that if I take the time just to think about it instead of reacting to a situation, that the source of it doesn't need to rise to that level of being angry. Sometimes I discover, you know, it's like Katie was talking about the irritation of things, that it's not necessary to be irritated about those things. You know, I put it more in perspective and pause and then move on. And then it just, some things don't really need to be an issue, even though at first I might think they do. Mm-hmm. But then I think about it and I'm like, that really doesn't need to be an issue. So then I feel more calm. And yeah, I just feel better if I'm not reacting to things that truly don't need to be reacted to.
I think for me, it's what doesn't happen, and that is I don't give myself the opportunity for regret, which inevitably will happen if I respond in the heat of the moment, and never goes well. So I think the, you know, what's interesting and about, you know, the impermanence of emotional states is exactly that. And whether or not I respond directly or not, that state is impermanent. And only thing I can do if I'm responding immediately in a heightened emotional state is make the situation worse. So I think yeah. So what comes to my mind is just the opportunity to not create a deeper hole.
Well, thanks. I think we could have talked about that one more. But it is 9 o'clock. So I will wrap up with our verse. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Good evening.
Good.
Hey, Tyler.
Yes.
Is your doggy still there? Can we see him closer?
Yeah, now he's just moved. Just went, Bertie, Bertie, come. Come here. You come up, you lazy little bit. She's so lazy.
It, and unfortunately, with black dogs, you
can't see anything.
They're just a big black blob.
Yeah, I send pictures to people, and they're like, I guess it's cute. Huh? Well, now that it's big, when it was little, they're like, see, and now it just flopped back down on the ground again. Like, this is like, it's the, after, I think, like, after 6 o'clock, she's just pure Burmese mountain dog who just lays around. Like, it's like there's no poodle left in her after 6 o'clock. Yeah, I'm talking about you.
Funny. Thank you.
No problem. All right.
See ya. Good night.